Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, entering the era of Trump, a look at his cabinet, the forces behind it, and its threat to the public's interest. My guest today will be Danny Sheehan. Danny is one of the nation's most important and influential constitutional and public interest lawyers. He has been at this for more than 45 years. He has been a central part of historical events such as the Pentagon Papers. Now, we know that Daniel Ellsberg was the one who brought forth the information that became the Pentagon Papers, but it was Danny Sheehan who was asked, should we publish them, by the New York Times. He was influential with information behind the Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, Karen Silkwood murder case, and so many more. He is here today to share his insight. He is the author of The People's Advocate. He was a Harvard University graduate. He also has a background from Harvard Divinity School. And his websites are Daniel P. Sheehan, that's Sheehan.com, and RomeroInstitute.org. Nice to have you with us today, Danny.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary. It's good to be here.
Danny, I want to begin our program today with a commentary from Chris Hedges from Truthdig. Mm-hmm. It is called Building the Institutions for Revolt. I think it's relevant to our discussion. I won't read the entire thing, but enough to get the flavor of what he is saying. He says, politics is a game of fear. Those who do not have the ability to make power elites afraid are not succeeding. All of the movements that opened up the democratic space in America, all of them, the suffragettes, the abolitionists, the labor movement, the communists, the socialists, the anarchists, and the civil rights movement, developed a critical mass and militancy that forced the centers a power to respond. The platitudes about justice, equality, and democracy are just that. Only when power becomes worried about its survival does it react. Appealing to its better nature is useless. It doesn't have one. We once had within our capitalist democracy liberal institutions. They included the press, labor unions, third-party parties, civic and church groups, public broadcasting, well-funded public universities, and a liberal wing of the Democratic Party that were capable of responding to outside pressure from movements. They did so imperfectly. They provided only enough reforms to save the capitalist system from widespread unrest or, with the breakdown of capitalism in the 1930s, from revolution. They never address white supremacy and institutional racism or the cruelty that is endemic in capitalism. But they had the ability to address and ameliorate the suffering of working class men and women. These liberal institutions collapsed under sustained assault during the past 40 years of corporate power. They exist now only in name. They are props in the democratic facade. Liberal nonprofits from Move On to Sierra Club are no better. They are pathetic appendages to the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party, as the community organizer Michael Geagan said, is not a functioning political party, but a permanent mobilization. It is propped up with corporate money and by a hyperventilating media machine. It practices political coronations and manipulative voters who have no real say in party politics. They are, as the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin reminds us, no institutions left in America that can authentically be called democratic. But even more ominously, the militant movements that were the real engines of democratic change have been obliterated by the multi-pronged assault of the witch hunts, McCarthyism, along with deindustrialization, a slew of anti-labor laws and deregulation, of corporate seizure of our public and private institutions. This has left us nearly defenseless. The corporate state ignores the suffering of the majority of Americans. It rams through policies that make the suffering worse. This is about to get turbocharged under Donald Trump. Institutions, the courts among them, that once were able to check the excesses of power are slavish subsidiaries of corporate America. and the more prescient critics of corporate power, Noam Chomsky, Ralph Nader, and others, have been blacklisted and locked out by corporate media, including the public broadcasting system that defends corporate interest and depends upon corporate money. We will build movements, and most importantly, new parallel institutions that challenge the hegemony of corporate power. It will not be easy. It will take time. We must not accept foundation money and grants from established institutions that seek to curtail the radical process of reconstituting society. Trusting in the system, and especially the Democratic Party, to carry out reform and wrest back our democracy ensures enslavement. And it goes on from there. But I believe that is a good place to begin.
Wow.
Now, Danny, right now, the entirety of the corporate liberal establishment from the New York Times, CNN, Washington Post, MSNBC, the Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, the Boston Globe, they are all lining up in support of the Democratic Party and against Trump. Every single day, I read all their headlines, and they're all parroting the same talking points. This could not be inadvertent. It has to be planned. And so they're going after his appointments. I would like for you to go through the existing appointments, the people who will become the overseers of each of the bureaucracies. And the most important ones, like Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of the Interior, Secretary of Education. These people have enormous power. They have giant bureaucracies and hundreds of billions of dollars to work with. Now, they all have something in common. The vast majority are billionaires. They have spent their entire career very successfully making money for themselves and their partners, whether it's hedge funds or equity partnerships. But they have never been shown to protect the interest of or make money for or improve the lot of the average person, small businesses, homeowners. They are all anti-environmental. They are all global warming denialists. They are all people who believe in complete deregulation. They are all neo-capitalist. They believe in the big world movement. I'd like for you to take that on first, but then at the same time, I'm asking you an extended question. I've gone through the list of all of the major appointments that were part of Obama's administration, and before that, Bush's administration, and before that, Clinton's administration, and before that, Reagan's administration. And for the last 32 years, for each administration, I find the same identical types of people, whether it's Robert Rubin or any of the other people. They all came from corporate America. I couldn't find a single progressive, a single populist in the last 32 years. So I would like your thoughts about how hypocritical it is to focus only upon Trump, but not upon what would have been another Clinton group. If you look at Obama's group and Clinton's group, when he was in the White House and she was in the White House, they're the same institutions, as if these people weren't the purveyors of a oligarchical duopoly. The forum is yours.
Wow. This is a very thoughtful articulation of the challenges that we're faced with here, Gary. I must say that in all of the 47 years or so that I've been out in the field since leaving law school at Harvard, that this is the most challenging time that I've ever seen in having to really reach back into virtually everything that I've read, everything that I've been taught, everything that I've talked about with my friends and associates. to figure out what exactly is the right way to respond to what it is that's going on here. That what Chris Hedges has done, of course, is in a certain sense a very important service in that he has articulated kind of full-throatedly the entire kind of alternative ethos to what it is that is being enunciated now by the Trump administration that you accurately point out. And we're faced with the very thing you also point out is that virtually all of the major corporate media and all of the institutions have basically lined up behind the regular, new, more moderate Democratic Party that has arisen since the end of the Cold War in 1992. And that they're basically paving the way for a reestablishment of the Democrat, or new, more moderate Democratic Party as the party that virtually everybody is supposed to support, that basically has a political IQ above room temperature, that are supposed to sort of rush into supporting in 2020 and going, oh, boy, is that good that this is over with Trump and his ideologues that are here. That is the option. These are two options that are being tendered right now. The option number one of the national news media and the regular Democratic Party, and Chris Hedges' articulation of attempting to dig in our heels and take this kind of radical position, even unto mobilizing to threaten the elite with fear, not just fear that they would lose power, but fear that they would be in some physical danger from a militantly mobilized radical movement, the only kind of thing that'll make change. Those are troubling oppositions in alternatives. That you raise the issue of the spiritual element that is missing. In ironically, you know, Chris Hedges, you know, we had Chris here in Santa Cruz, and our office co-sponsored a major presentation by him, and he has become a minister, yes. Protestant minister, and yet you don't hear it in the things he's saying recently, because I think he's so upset about what's happened. So I would like to respond to that part of your observations. Because I believe that what has been said, for example, by Pope Francis in his major encyclical on global climate change that he published in June of 2015, called Laudato Si, which is "And the Care of Our Common Home," I believe that our progressive community, focusing on the issue of global climate change, which is going to be affecting everyone, and as you point out, virtually every single one of these nominees to every single one of the cabinet positions has taken an aggressive position against the steps that would be necessary to really effectively combat global climate change, even though there's some ameliorating statements that have been made by Rex Tillerson that, he's the only one that sort of even acknowledges that there is such a thing as global climate change. But the bottom line is that I believe that if we all mobilize around this issue of global climate change, which is just a physical reality that is descending upon us, and we look to Francis, not because he's the Pope or not because, you know, he's more brilliant than everyone else, but the fact of the matter is he occupies a position on the planet which attracts a lot of attention. People look to what he is saying. They listen to what he's saying. They're looking for his analysis. And in his encyclical, he has pointed out that the substantial portion of the global climate change that's taking place now is, in fact, the direct result of human activity. activity. And he points out very specifically that the proximate causation of this global climate change is the functioning of the transnational corporate capitalist economic system. And he points out that when you establish a shareholder-owned corporation as the principal vehicle by means of which business is conducted, and the development of resources, the production of products, and the distribution of products is generated by this particular business vehicle, you are inevitably going to have lead to this kind of crisis that has occurred on our globe, is that the corporation is so driven by generating increasing profits to be shared with the private stockholders, and the stockholders are immunized against any potential legal liability for the conduct of the corporation, and the board of directors is immunized, and the management are immunized, and that the only entity that is deemed to be liable for the conduct of the corporation is the corporation itself, to the point where they actually go to the point of acknowledging or asserting that the corporation is a person entitled to all of the same fundamental rights that a human being is entitled to. That is exactly what happened. I pointed it out earlier in our discussions. That's exactly what happened in the aftermath of the American Civil War, in the onset of the private shareholder-owned corporation that was actually instituted around 1872. And it actually, between 1872 and 1888, that the series of judicial opinions that were rendered by the federal court system that was filled with corporate lawyers from the railroad companies, the steel companies, the cattlemen's association, they appointed all of their lawyers to be judges in the federal system, who created this new business vehicle, immunizing their clients from legal liability. That Pope Francis has pointed out in his encyclical that particular type of vehicle makes it inevitable that they will destroy the planet, that they will consume all of the natural resources and transform them into a product in profit for themselves. So that type of a focus is so important, and he brings to bear on the analysis a spiritual analysis, saying that this institution of the private shareholder-owned corporation is a sinful structure that has to be addressed as such, because they have completely alienated from any type of moral responsibility the actual owners and those who profit from that business entity. And that's the problem that we're confronted by. And the fascist element of this Trump administration that you hear referred to now growingly, that this wedding between the interests of the corporations and the instrumentalities of the state, you know, as was pointed out, I think by the fellow who is the director of the he's the director of Public Citizen, Robert Weissman, you know, in an article on January 10th, the head of Public Citizen pointed out that. What we're really looking at here, he said, is that those who were the overlords, who were bribing our congressmen and senators and bribing the legislative leaders to do their bidding, have now been put in charge by Trump of the very agencies of government themselves. And so that what we're looking at is the classic manifestation of fascism, of the wedding of the interests of the corporations with the instrumentalities of power of the state. And so we're looking at a four-year period here, and I think to be realistic, it's not likely that we're going to get him impeached. That, as he has said himself, he could walk down Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody down and nothing would happen to him. That he's gotten himself in a situation now where he is going to be sitting atop all of these major corporate executives and financial people, from Goldman Sachs, and military officers. You know, you look across the panoply of these appointments, and you see millionaires everywhere, indeed billionaires, and military officials, and not just normal millionaires and generals, but hardcore right-wing fascist people in the military who have done ridiculous things, like you know, and with Steve Bannon being his principal strategic advisor, sitting at his right hand, you know, co-equal to the chief of staff, making him probably the second most powerful person after Trump in this government structure. And this is a guy who's self-consciously anti-Semitic, consistently, this is Steve Bannon, consistently making reference to the conspiracy of Jew bankers and media people working to oppose us white people. You know, he opposed his own daughter even attending the Archer School in L.A. because Jews go there. You know, you got John Weaver, who was the campaign director for Republican Governor John Kasich of Ohio, saying that Bannon's appointment, he's a racist. Racist, anti-Semitic, fascist. It was just footsteps from the Oval Office. Now, that's what we're getting ready to confront here. And it requires something more than falling prey to the exact same mistakes that were made in the late 1920s and in early 1930s in Germany, whereby the people listened to the clarion call of, for example, Chris Hedges that he is issuing to let's all gird our loins and dig our heels in and wage this assault unto basically threatening physical danger to the elite, because all that will happen is that the elite will dig in and they'll arm themselves, and they're already armed, and they'll resort to the National Security Advisor, they'll resort to the Homeland Security people, they'll do that, and
Danny,
we get is pitch battles in the street. We can't have that.
Okay, I appreciate that overview, and now I'd like to ask you a larger question. Because there's this assumption that somehow there's a them and there's the we.
Yeah.
And it doesn't exist. If you look at the reality, you had almost even with Clinton getting more of the popular vote by 2 or 3 million, but it was around 62 to 65 million votes that Trump got. Clinton got a little more. But 100 million people didn't vote, or could have. The independents represent the largest single bloc. In fact, they're as large as the Democrats and Republicans combined. And within the independent, you have an enormous amount of progressives. And my concern is that we're looking at this too close. So I'd like to pull back for a moment, and you'll see where I'm going with this. I believe that the entire institution of government, as it now exists, is incapable of governing in any sense in a democratic way, in a democracy. I believe that we are incapable of asking people or demanding that people in power relinquish that power to that which is in the common need of everyone, to the commons. They're not going to do it. I've never seen a situation.
That's right.
But if you go back and everything that you could criticize Trump for possibly doing, based upon his rhetoric, his misogyny, his racism, his intemperance, his immaturity, his lack of any sense of spiritual decorum or manners at all. I think that one of the reasons people, you know, kind of held their nose and voted for him was because everything that Obama promised in hope and change, especially for minorities, he never delivered. And yet, if you talk with the media today, they're angry that Clinton didn't win. So if you ask, well, what exactly did Bill Clinton do and Hillary Clinton do? Because they were co-presidents when they were in power for 8 years. And then what did Bush do? And then what did Obama do? The answer is nothing. All of them did the same thing. Now, I'm going to give you just an example. First off, look at the real legacy of Obama and Clinton, who was in his administration, because remember, any one of these people could have stood up to him and said, your policies in this area or that area should be questioned. They all had the right as cabinet members of private conversations with the president. And we never got any of this. For example, Obama said when he was going into office, he made 500 pledges during his two candidacies. And even taking away some of those that were trivial, it's still, let's just say, arguably 300 of these were very important to people. For example, he said that he, after winning the Nobel Prize for Peace, that he would not be interfering in other countries. He was against the nuclear weapons, etc. He put more special operation forces in more countries, 75 countries, than any other president. And he also completely deregulated all arms exports to from the United States, and over $200 billion, that's the most in history, of arms went to countries. And many of those largest arms purchases were with rogue nations, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, and United Arab Emirates. He also, at no point did he publicly chastise or put any sanctions against or any restrictions upon any country that was arming, training, abetting, protecting, and facilitating terrorism, such as ISIS and al-Nusra and al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia, Turkey. And we even had the former top investigator within the Turkish government on terrorism, who has come forward now and has written a critique showing that everybody knew that the ISIS could not be touched. They knew that at all checkpoints, more than 14,000 tanker trucks could go from Turkey into Syria and into Iraq, steal their oil, bring it back in. And it was the son of the leader, Erdogan's son, who would then take care of disposing of that oil on the black market. But al-Qaeda was getting anywhere from $1 to $4 million a day. And not once did Obama or Secretary of Defense or head of the CIA or head of Homeland Security or the National Security Agency say, let's bomb those 14,000 trucks. They were never bombed by the United States. Russia came in and immediately bombed them. We didn't. We didn't talk about it. The American media that should have known this was going on, it was no secret, never put a single story in any of the major media that I could find on the fact that the United States' allies and the United States were aiding and abetting the very thing that we told the world we should be terrified of, and that is a terrorist, because we were behind it. Also, it was Obama who ignited a new 21st century Cold War with Russia. You just mentioned that the Cold War ended in 1992 with the dissolution of the Soviet Union. But he did go after Russia by putting on sanctions and then starting a new nuclear arms race, which he then promised $1 trillion, which would have been now, we figure, $1.5 trillion. And yet no protest by the American media, including the liberal media, most of the liberal media, with the exceptions being maybe Mother Jones and The Nation magazine and a few others. But The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times, all which are supposed to be the so-called liberal media, not only did not challenge how in the world could you win a Nobel Peace Prize and then start the largest nuclear proliferation since the end of the Cold War, but what would that $1 trillion have done if put back into our cities, our schools, our infrastructures? That was never even a discussion. Also, it was under Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton that we had regime changes in Paraguay, Honduras, Libya, Egypt, with the Arab Spring, Ukraine, and now Syria, and a war in Yemen. Not once have I seen any major editorial in any of the major liberal media talk about the human consequences of suffering and death and destruction in Yemen. And that is solely our responsibility, because we are giving the jets, the bombs, we are giving all of the intel to Saudi Arabia to go into the poorest country in the Middle East. The bottom half of Saudi Arabia is Yemen, and it's all because of the geostrategical position of its shoreline. And they wanting to protect this pass there where ships go through. And we're not even told the truth of that. We're not told the truth of how the Saudi Arabians got to be the chair of the Human Rights Committee at the United Nations when they beheaded as many people as ISIS, where we were offended by one set of beheadings, this flogging of women who were raped. We flogged, Saudi Arabia flogged the victims. And where was the protest from the so-called women advocates in our administration or in Congress or in the government or in the media? It was non-existent. Then he promised greater transparency of government ethics and information. We got the most secretive, least transparent administration in history. Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder adopted all of Bush's arguments that would discard legal cases against the government, and thereby expanding the definition and content of secret state or state secrets. He expanded warrantless spying. He expanded surveillance across all agencies. He promised tougher rules on lobbyists and former federal officials, and no lobbyists would work on regulations. Today, lobbyists work on every type of regulation. They literally write the rules that then the legislators accept and make into laws for everything. He promised tax cuts of 95% of families, and giving them tax credit never reached that amount. And he promised to unite Democrats and Republicans. That didn't happen. He promised to take money out of financing elections. Didn't happen. He reneged on that. In fact, he personally raised more private monies than any other president in history. And yet he lied and called it a grassroots. It wasn't. And where did those corporate bundlers go? They became ambassadors. And warrantless surveillance, he promised to reduce and restrict warrantless wiretapping. Now the U.S. Freedom Act is one of the worst in history, and he got Facebook, Google, and Microsoft to join in supplying us with surveillance information on average citizens. He could have done universal health care. He promised it when he was running. Instead, he gave us this monstrosity, this Frankenstein of Obamacare, where 28.5 million are still uninsured. And he promised to reform the VA. He didn't. He promised us to go more green. Instead, he put more money behind clean coal, nuclear, and gas hydrofracking. He promised to reduce oil consumption by 35%. It didn't happen. It increased. And he also expanded hydrofracking. He expanded the nuclear power renaissance, he called it. And he also was part of a bill that concealed nuclear power leaks from the public. And he promised that we would label GMOs, genetically modified organisms. Then he turned around and passed the DARK Act, which makes it impossible to label GMOs. He promised to stop home foreclosures. He could have done that with executive order. Not at all. There wasn't a single home that was not foreclosed. We had 28 million Americans lose their home. And his troubled asset relief program was a colossal failure, and that's according to the Treasury Special Inspector General. He promised urban renewal of our inner cities and ghetto neighborhoods. Now we have further degradation of poorer communities into slums. And he promised not to bail out Wall Street. He bailed out Wall Street, General Motors, Chrysler, but he didn't bail out small businesses and U.S. citizens. He secretly negotiated the TPP and the TTIP agreements, which those alone, if they were passed, would end our sovereignty as a nation forever. And he also opposed any attempts to alter NAFTA. And he allowed the FBI and Homeland Security to infiltrate every single Occupy Wall Street movement, every environmental movement, human rights movement, every movement that was positive. He allowed them to infiltrate, and he sent more immigrants back to their countries than any other president. And so if we're going to look at what Trump can do now, in no small measure, Trump now has the capacity to do more bad things because of the laws that the so-called liberal Democrats allowed to be passed without comment, without protest, including going after more whistleblowers than all other presidents combined. The National Defense Authorization Act that specifically targets journalists and free speech, and it would target you as well, Danny, and myself. He also was the first president to actually feel good about being able to select without any legal authority or legal due process the ability to detain on suspicion alone or assassinate any citizen or person in the world. And he supported the Patriot Act, and he had the most rapid privatization of schools ever. And he supported Common Core, which is the most stupid thing a student can take. And so those are some things that this, not just president, but this corporatized entire bureaucracy in Washington supports, because the people controlling everything behind the scenes. So it doesn't really matter whether it's Trump or anyone else. And why they fear Trump, I believe, is because Trump wasn't used to working with people in a cooperative way, especially the way that the others had, and they didn't know what the outcome would be. Because if they believed that they could get along with Trump, then it would have been a completely different story. They knew they had control of Clinton. They knew they had control of Bush. They knew they had control of Obama. They didn't know they could control Trump. Could you address these, please?
Well, I think that what you're saying is extraordinarily important for people to grasp, that this mobilization of all of the major news media in the country and all of their journalists and all of their talking heads that they're having on now, taking this kind of self-righteous position that they're going to be attacking Trump because of the characteristics of his appointees and his policies, which, as you point out correctly, are so extraordinarily similar to the policies that Obama's administration and, very importantly, this new, more moderate Democratic Party are supporting right now. I think it's extraordinarily important for people to hearken back to this point where Gorbachev ended the Soviet Union by authorizing the release of all of the different republics to become independent if they chose to on December 31st of 1992, that was the moment at which, as you recall, the Democratic Party, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Democratic Party, that what they did is they immediately mobilized under Richard Gebhardt from Indiana. They mobilized this Democratic Leadership Conference in that they said, look, let's retool and reconfigure the entire regular Democratic Party because it's no longer necessary for us to provide a reasonable social democratic alternative to the Republican Party to neutralize the potential effectiveness of socialism. And so what they did is they moved to the right of center very aggressively and set up camp at the right of center. And at the same time, the Republican Party, as we know, the very Monday morning following the dissolution of the Soviet Union on December 31st of 1992, the very following Monday, Paul Wolfowitz inside the Defense Department under Cheney in the George H.W. Bush administration gathered in the West Wing of the White House, and they prepared this entire document called the 1992 United States Defense Department Policy Planning Guidance Document, where they actually proposed that the United States military increase our military spending and that we establish full spectrum dominance over the world. And so they moved aggressively to the extreme right wing and stopped even pretending that they were anything other than that. In the Democratic Party, what Gebhardt kept referring to as the new, more moderate Democratic Party, followed them right to the right. And that's what we're confronted by now. We have two political parties in the United States, one that's a hardcore right wing party, which is dramatically revealed behind the mask by Trump appointees that we see here. And the other one, we have this clear right of center, new, more moderate Democratic Party, typified by Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Remember, Hillary Clinton was the chairperson of the policy committee of the new Democratic Party. And so what we're really having to be confronted by now is, what is the alternative? What is the option that we have in front of us? How is it that we can go about effectively establishing a genuinely progressive political organization and structure in the United States in the face of this coalition that exists between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, all to the right of center, Republicans extremely right of center, the Democrats substantially to the right of center? How can we establish a party, a movement that brings us back to the center? center or to the left of center with regard to social policies. That's the challenge that we're facing. And I refer people to Michael Harrington's work. Michael Harrington, who was the head of the Democratic Socialist Party in the United States for many, many years before he died of cancer, in his final book, which he entitled Present at God's Funeral was the name of it, he pointed out that until the Democratic Socialist movement in the United States comes to understand what the progressive Catholic mobilization and social justice community understands, we're not going to be able to succeed. And that's what he's suggesting, is that the spiritual element needs to be at the core of a mobilization of a genuinely progressive political movement in the United States. And that's why I hearken back to the Chautauqua movement that was generated by the National Board of Homeland Ministry back in 1874 in response to the robber barons, in response to the ascendancy to power of the corporate magnates during the robber baron era. That Chautauqua movement that was infused with genuine spiritual values is what mobilized the women's suffrage movement, mobilized the anti-child labor movement, mobilized the public education system, mobilized the initial environmental movement. All of these things came out of that movement. I believe that we have to give rebirth to this Chautauqua movement and take advantage of all of the modern media access we have now through the internet and radio shows like this. We have to mobilize, and we need to establish a government in waiting. We need to establish a clear government, which is an alternative to the Trump administration, but at the same time is a true alternative to the simple reactive return to placing the new, more moderate Democratic Party back into power in 2020. As we say, everybody, as you point out, all of the major news media are all lining up behind simply returning to the new, more moderate Democratic Party, headed up by Elizabeth Warren, you know, and promising all these same promises that Obama made in his campaigns, which they won't fulfill. They'll still be married at the hip, you know, to the major corporations and the banks and the finances and the pharmaceutical industry and the major media industry, corporate industry. We need to return to the Chautauqua movement, establish a new government in waiting. I believe that we have to be able to tender people who are going to articulate and elucidate clear alternative progressive programs to face guard virtually the president of the United States, Trump, Mike Pence, his vice president, to face guard Rex Tillerson, to face guard Steve Mnuchin at the Treasury, to face guard Jim Mattis at the Defense Department, to face guard Michael Pompeo at the CIA, to say, look, not only are we criticizing what it is they're doing as blatant fascism that we encountered back during, before World War II, but in fact, we need to have a concrete alternative to them in place, full sets of policies.
Danny?
That's what we need.
Okay, Danny, it was Confucius who said, the people may be made to follow a path of action, but they may not be made to understand it. And in that light, I see that there are many people, well-intentioned, who will go out and protest, who will engage in civil disobedience, without thinking, what is the likely blowback from 65 million people who are going to be supporting Trump no matter what until he lets them down? I believe in the end he'll let them down, not be able to do what he promised, and then that base will erode and that will be it for him. But you're going to have blowback sooner or later in a lot of areas. It was James Madison in a speech in Virginia at the Virginia Convention who said, I believe there are more instances of abridgment of the freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. And he said that in 1788. I believe that we now have in front of us, with Citizens United, with the corporatization of everything, the privatization of everything, the inability of anyone in power to fight the forces in power And when you've had an Alan Grayson, when you've had a Ron Paul, when you've had some people who on many ideas were willing to fight, they were in a minority, so much of a minority, they were considered an acceptable abridgment to how business is done. At the same time, and this is the second connection to what I just said, I believe that we must protest, but going into a demonstration in and of itself is not enough. You and I have been part of movements. We both led movements. And we know that it's you have to look at something over years, not hours. You have to look at showing up. When we were banning DDT, there sometimes be five or six of us. And that was it. But in time, in 1972, we got it banned, all based upon the original work of the great marine biologist and American heroine who founded this whole movement. It was Ralph Nader who gave it its dimensions, but it was Rachel Carson with Silent Spring that gave us the education. I believe we need more articles, books, and documentaries on institutions that have betrayed us. I believe the public doesn't like to see something that shows they've been lied to and had. If we had more documentaries on the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Federal Reserve, upon Citizens United, if we had a documentary showing that how, as you were talking earlier, how corporations were considered with the same rights as individuals. So you, if a corporation engaged in illegal activities, you fined the corporation, but nothing happened. Like Vioxx killed a minimum of 60,000 people, but corrected figures later should have been 500,000. And the company paid a fine, made about $16 billion net, did not have to give any of its money back. And its reputation went on, improved, and the stock went up. After killing that many people, and I thought at the time, how could you kill 60 million people? By the way, with malice aforethought, because it was shown by Dr. Graham at the FDA that they knew they had a medication that would increase heart attack and stroke. And then you look at the people who, like the British Petroleum, and you look at the fact that they instigated a coup against Mojaddegh, a democratically elected intellectual pacifist in Iraq or Iran. Yeah. And Eisenhower went for it. The British government insisted upon it, and it happened. And the CIA helped to get it in motion. We substituted a democratically elected Iran that would be our friends today with the Shah of Iran that killed tens of thousands, imprisoned hundreds of thousands, and led to the Iranian Revolution. But the average American doesn't know that history. They are ignorant. What the American today knows is what they've read last or heard last, and most of that is not accurate. So if we had a movement where the 100 to 200 leading journalists, activists, progressives, and there's only about 200 of us in America that are actually leading. You can't name more than about 200. There are others who don't do anything, who are there to give some support, but they're not out there getting themselves arrested. They're not writing the books, the articles. But if we had more information going out, and then if we had a national boycott, if we took some of the people that Trump has surrounded himself, or for that matter, Obama, or the Clintons, or the Bushes, and we boycotted their companies. We took all of our money out of their banks. We stopped using their credit cards. We stopped buying their clothes that were created by slave labor in Bangladesh or China or India. If we stop having hardwood furniture that was destroying the rainforest, if we stop asking for plastic, instead use paper, if we stop buying stuff we didn't need and lived more with a sense of austerity and spirituality, if we stop buying anything that was not organically grown and started supporting local initiatives for farmers markets and local farmers and sustainable agriculture, these are not difficult things to do. The average person can do this. And if we showed why they should do that, then we would have an enormous impact. Because if enough people got behind a movement like this, and you're talking about 100 million independents, so if they saw, you see, I think one of the biggest errors in judgment that everyone is making now is they think you have to have a new political movement to take the place of Trump. And you're correctly stating that you need to take the place of all the institutions in Washington by a group of independents whether it's the Justice Party, the Green Party, the Constitution Party. There are a lot of parties out there that never get any publicity. But if you talk with them, there are reasonable positions they take. So if we just stop this, if we stopped visiting a state for vacation that supported hydrofracking, like Oklahoma, North Dakota. That would hurt their economy. We got to send an economic message, because I believe that the only pain that these people in power ever feel is an economic pain. So those are some of the things I would like to do. And I don't believe that a march in and of itself will do anything. Your thoughts?
I think what we need is, as I've said, Gary, is that we need to rebirth the Chautauqua movement, to move around the country, to hold major rallies, because the Chautauqua movement was essentially educational. It was consciousness raising for the people. It had reading assignments. It had discussion groups. It had entertainment. It had poetry. It had literature. Eugene Debs spoke there. Susan B. Anthony spoke there. Clarence Darrow spoke there. What we need to do is get our people, mobilized, and we need to recognize that there needs to be an attractor to draw the people in, a major revival of a genuinely spiritual perspective of caring for our fellow human beings, not just viewing them as consumers. But we need to mobilize these boycotts. It's going to be extraordinary. Important, and at the same time, we need to put forth a government in waiting. We need to demonstrate that there are concrete alternatives and positive alternatives that are practical, that are workable, and that there are people who will lead these departments. And that's what I think we need to do. And I say that we focus in a significant part upon the global climate change issue and what the corporations are that are negatively impacting that process. Because that phenomenon of global climate change is going to continue to occur, and it's going to push more and more and more people to come to these Chautauqua gatherings. And we'll have people like Jackson Brown there and Bonnie Raitt there and Bruce Springsteen. We'll have people come and perform, but we'll have people speaking, not just like 2 minutes in the midst of a concert. We need to have genuine educational experiences in this Chautauqua movement. I can go talk to Joan Campbell, who is the head of the Chautauqua movement, now much more restricted, used to be the head of the National Council of Churches. I can talk, I'm on my way on Monday to Rome to sit down with Cardinal Turkson, Peter Turkson, who is the co-author with Francis of the global encyclical on climate change. I'm going to be meeting with the Assistant Secretary of State, Paul Gallagher, there, and I'm going to be meeting with them because I'm trying to get Pope Francis to sign a letter stating that the churches and synagogues setting up solar power on their roofs and giving away energy to the poor to remove the clients of the Pacific Gas and Electric Company that are using coal and oil and fracking natural gas. We've got to mobilize a full-scale movement. This is the moral equivalent of a war, but not a war that threatens physical violence against the elite. That's not what we're doing. What we're doing is we're growing a concrete, constructive alternative in using spiritual values, not because we're trying to recruit people, to join a religious group of one sort or another, but to understand what the relationship is that the Native American people understand between their spiritual lives and the economy and the world and the other living systems in the world. This is a major movement that needs to be mobilized, and you will play a significant part in this because of all the work that you've done dealing with people's health and healthy eating and habits. It will play a major role in this at the Romero Institute because of our work in the past confronting the fascist powers that have existed in the Enterprise and others, confronting the dangers of nuclear a renewal of nuclear power, that we did in the Karen Silkwood case, and hopefully we'll be able to draw Chris Hedges, you know, in his newfound membership as a Protestant minister, back away from this edge of basically mobilizing a physically threatening mobilization against the elite. We cannot be relying
They'll pound
on fear.
Danny, I believe when that happens,
fear.
They're going the elite are going to pound the movement
That's
into the ground.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. You know, we cannot mobilize on the basis of fear. We have to mobilize on the power of love and affection and caring for other human beings. And that's what distinguishes Francis in the global Catholic climate movement and the whole area around the global greenhouse gas emissions. This is predicated upon endorsing life. This is a genuinely pro-life movement, but it's pro-life in the sense of the life of the planet, the life of our human species as a whole. This is the new spirituality, the new paradigm that has to be mobilized. And this is the way, in my opinion, which is a substantially different call than Chris is making. And hopefully we can recruit Chris Hedges to come and join this and emphasize the newfound spiritual dimension of his political analysis. That's what I believe.
I think those are very important beliefs. I also believe that we must work at the local level.
Yes.
If all the energy is trying to have some representation in Washington, you know how the system works.
Yeah, I do.
You know that even some idealists get co-opted in that system.
Yep.
When you have 200,000 people all working just for the military-industrial complex in Washington and Virginia, their way is the way that gets done. You may be an outside voice, but if we could get people at the local levels, at the state levels, if we could expose Alex, if we could expose the legislators that support Alex's agenda, if we could show that we're not going to take their vaccines, we're not going to eat their junk food, we're not going to go to McDonald's and these other places. Now, the vast majority of Americans, and this will take time because people won't change until A, they are desperate, B, there's a crisis, C, there is enough information to let them know that there is a better way. And then we start to see people then making that shift over. And especially if you can make it show that people could save money and get healthier and prevent disease and overcome their high blood pressure if they ate better, but at the same time they're eating better, they're taking money away from GMOs. They're taking money out of Monsanto's pocket, out of McDonald's pocket, out of Burger King's pocket, out of these corporate merger pockets. And if we start buying clothes made in America, that also impacts them. So I believe that we need a practical, pragmatic, spiritual movement. And if we just go out there and we confront them, they will win. And that's not the way to do it, in my belief. And I believe that we're both on the same page in that respect, Danny.
In that type of a dialectical confrontation. But what we need, the community choice energy companies that we're talking about setting up now, you know, these are all organized on the local level. It's getting the members of the county board of supervisors to approve the establishment of a community choice energy company, which in fact is going to be purchasing the excess energy that the churches and synagogues and temples and others and the private homes that are generating electricity with the solar panels on the roofs of their homes. Right now, PG&E, for example, the Pacific Gas and Electric, limits the amount of excess energy you can sell back into the grid to only 5% more than your previous electric bill. But now, with the community choice energy companies, there's no limit on the amount of excess energy that you can sell back into the community choice energy company, and they will resell that clean energy at like only 3/4 of what it costs for the dirty energy generated by Pacific Gas and Electric. So people are saving 25% on their electric bill. They're getting. We believe that in the Monterey diocese here in California, we're going to be able to reduce by 90% the global greenhouse gas emissions by 2025. Now, this is actually in keeping with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change of the United Nations.
Danny,
we're
out of time.
Make this work.
You're right. It will work. And this is just one step in that direction. Danny Sheehan, thank you for being with us today on the Progressive Commentary Hour.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Right on.
mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, brother, brother,